Okay, what do we typically mean by a soul, at least nowadays? By the word soul, most of us would use that word almost interchangeably with the word mind. We seem to operate implicitly by what Herbert Dreyfuss and Charles Taylor call the dualist sorting. That is, we take as our default assumption that all things can be assigned to one of two exhaustive categories, the mental or the material, or we might even say the physical. On the one hand, there are ordinary attributes we find among physical objects, their location, their velocity, their mass, their charge when we're doing science. On the other hand, there are mental attributes such as thinking, willing, qualitative consciousness, etc. The former are revealed by objective, quantitative methods of the natural sciences, whereas the latter are accessible only through the first-person awareness of some consciousness or other. That is, there are two distinct aspects to the world, the mental and the physical, or so the story goes. I clearly have physical attributes. I weigh 81 kilograms. I'm traveling at 30 kilometers per second along with the rest of the Earth, around the Sun. I am located within a few meters of Professor Johnston, etc. It is equally clear that I also have conscious or mental attributes. I am thinking about the philosophy of mind. I see various colors. I believe today is Thursday, and so forth. Though it has been claimed otherwise by various metaphysicians over the centuries, it is hard to go in for the notion that attributes float freely from the things of which they are the attributes. For example, where we find red, we also find an object or a substance, to use the philosopher's term, that is red. Attributes are ways of being. So for each case or instance of an attribute, there must be a substance that is that way. What is the substance that exists in the ways that I just mentioned as among my physical attributes? Well, it is pretty obvious that it is my body, this organism, that weighs 81 kilograms, is traveling through space, and is located a few meters from Professor Johnston. That is, it is a physical substance, my body, that has my physical attributes. What has my mental or conscious attributes? According to the typical line of thought, just as there must be a physical substance that has my physical attributes, there must be a non-physical substance that has my non-physical attributes. This non-physical substance that supposedly bears my non-physical attributes is what we typically mean by the word soul or the mind. The idea here is that behind, in some sense, this podium, and I'm really glad there was a podium when I wrote this. The idea here is that behind, in some sense, this podium, there are in fact two substances, a body and a soul. If we were to count the substances or individual things in this room, we would have to count twice in my vicinity, once for my body and once for my soul. For this reason, the position I am sketching is often called substance dualism, as it takes a human person, or maybe all conscious beings, to involve two distinct substances, a body and a soul. One, on some versions of substance dualism, the human person just is the soul that happens to be closely associated with a body. Other substance dualists claim that the human person is the composition of a soul and a body, which are themselves nevertheless independent substances. Which of these views should be preferred among substance dualists does not concern us this afternoon, and I might say it's someone else's problem. Okay. The key point is that, according to the substance dualist, for each person in this room, there are two substances, a body bearing her physical attributes and a soul bearing her mental attributes. Notice that the typical substance dualist, whether she identifies the person just with the soul or the composite of the soul and the body, claims that the identity of the person is more significantly tied to the soul. Since the soul is supposedly the seat of our mental attributes, and our personalities seem to be aggregates of our mental attributes or mental dispositions, the substance dualist is likely to take the coming to be and passing away of a human person as tied to the existence or non-existence of the soul. In short, for the substance dualist, my coming to be and passing away is an immaterial affair, the coming to be and passing away of a non-physical substance. What is the relationship between the soul and the body? The relationship will just be a special case of the relationship between any two distinct substances. Suppose we have two billiards balls, an eight ball and a two ball. Though maybe not paradigmatic substances, the two billiards balls are distinct individuals. Notice that the existence of one does not presuppose the existence of the other. We could destroy the eight ball while doing no harm to the two ball, leaving aside its prospects for taking place in a proper game of pool. Changes in the one likewise do not necessitate changes in the other. For example, if we painted the eight ball pink, that would in no way change the two ball intrinsically. The eight ball and the two ball only affect each other by external causal relations. That is, the eight ball can change the two ball only by acting on it from the outside, say, by a collision that causes a change in course or velocity. Similarly, the substance dualist must claim that the soul and the body are related by external causation. The existence of the soul and the body do not presuppose each other, at least not on standard versions of substance dualism, and changes in the soul do not necessitate changes in the body and vice versa. Rather, the soul and the body must act on each other much like our billiard balls in order to take place in significant relations. Supposedly, an act of my soul, such as an intention to reach for a glass of water, sets off a process in my body, beginning with events in my nervous system and terminating the motion of my arm toward a glass. Though the soul is distinct from the body, occurrences in my body can be causes of occurrences. Occurrences in my soul can be causes of occurrences in my body. Most relevantly, occurrences in my nervous system and vice versa. Substance dualism can probably be defended, but the metaphysical acrobatics necessary to do so are expensive, so much so that we do well to look elsewhere for an account of soul and body. There are many sticky problems raised against substance dualism. Historically, the main worry has been whether mind-body causation is even possible. Our basic notions of external causal relations are built around the notion of physical contact, such as the collision of two billiards balls. In what sense can we say that the soul and the body can come into causal contact? If one of the terms of this relation is supposedly a non-spatial entity, what is non-spatial contact? Moreover, our basic physical laws tell us that the total motion or energy in the physical world must remain constant. Wouldn't the soul's causal influence on the body amount to an addition of motion into the world from the outside, thereby violating these conservation laws? Over the years, dualists have come up with ingenious ways to address these issues, such that all we can say is that soul-body causation is weird or hard to grasp, but it doesn't seem to be utterly impossible. We've come to learn that there are plenty of very weird ways the world actually works. The worry for me, however, is not whether soul-body causation is possible, but whether it is superfluous. Indeed, increasingly seems so. As the neurological sciences advance, we are cumulatively building a picture of the nervous system that seems to be tightly causally gapless. That is, we are not discovering neurological events that do not have prior physical causes, which would leave us space to posit the influence of a non-physical agency, such as a soul. There doesn't seem to be any need to conclude that something on the physical side of things needs a non-physical explanation. Moreover, as these same sciences advance, we are not discovering any gaps between occurrences in the nervous system and mental events. Though the picture is far from complete, it appears that occurrences in the nervous system and the organism more broadly, interaction with the environment, are necessary and sufficient for all mental occurrences. In other words, there doesn't seem to be any real need to conclude that something from the mental side of things needs a non-physical explanation. Thus, there seems to be no reason to believe that there is a non-physical substance, a soul, in order to account for the occurrence of our mental acts. Furthermore, the emerging picture is not one that sits well with the claim that the body and the soul are externally related similarly to the relation between two billiards balls. As the sciences discover the physical basis of many psychological pathologies, the possibility of manipulating conscious phenomena chemically and by direct stimulation, and the dependence of consciousness itself on the operation of structures in the nervous system as part of an organism interacting with an environment, it is more than merely plausible that the existence of the soul does presuppose the existence of the body and that changes in the body do necessitate changes in the soul. Of course, the neurophysiological picture is far from complete, and there's much that we don't know in this vicinity. Whatever has been claimed in popular presentations of neuroscience, we are far from a complete mapping of human psychology onto the nervous system. That has not been done, and maybe it can't be. I'll leave that concern for the experts, and I'll just bank on what the emerging picture in general looks like. Moreover, I'm not denying that there are quite obdurate problems in the philosophy of mind regarding the relation of consciousness to its apparent physical substrate, the problems that may well ultimately be unsolvable for us. Nevertheless, just as one ought to be wary of the God of the gaps, we should be equally vigilant against the soul of the gaps. The lack of a scientific explanation, at least for the moment, is not the same thing as having a good reason for a non-scientific explanation. Furthermore, for my money, the real sticking point follows from the principle of methodological naturalism. By methodological naturalism, I mean simply that regular occurrences in nature have natural explanations. That is, types of events that take place in the regular course of things within the time-space network have explanations in terms of things that take place within or exist within the time-space network. Nature does not operate by miracles. In fact, that's probably all we can really mean by natural. That's not to say that miracles don't occur, because by definition, miracles are not occurrences in the ordinary course of things. Be that as it may, mental events and their corresponding neurophysiological events are certainly occurrences in the natural course of things. So we should expect that there is some natural explanation for them, even if that explanation is currently or even permanently beyond our ken. Thus, there is little reason to believe and plenty reason to doubt that there is a substantial soul causally interacting with the body. Does that mean that there is no soul? I think not. But that does mean we will have to use soul in a sense distinct from how we are used to using that term. Though in the sense that I'm going to propose to you, we really have the original meaning of the word, though I wish we had another one. Okay. Take an ordinary organism, a cat named Fluffy. Is Fluffy identical to the physical parts that compose him? Is Fluffy that collection of parts and nothing more? This is going to sound odd, but Fluffy is not identical to his collection of physical parts, and that for two reasons. First, Fluffy's parts can exist without Fluffy. For example, if Fluffy were to have an unfortunate encounter with a wood chipper, we could retain all of Fluffy's parts, and yet we would lose Fluffy. Apologies to cats. The remnants at the far side of the wood chipper, though potentially a cat, are not a cat. Note, at that point, the parts are equally potentially dog parts as they are cat parts. Second, although Fluffy cannot exist without some set of cat parts or other, he certainly can exist without any particular set of cat parts. Through the normal process of metabolism, Fluffy changes out parts at the molecular level throughout his entire lifespan. In fact, there is no privileged set of parts that Fluffy will maintain for his entire duration. Thus, Fluffy and any one collection of parts that compose him can exist without each other, at least at different times. And therefore, they are not the very same thing, though certainly Fluffy cannot exist without some set of appropriate cat parts. Cats are not identical to their parts, but neither are they externally related to them. Fluffy's parts are certainly potentially a cat, but they are not in themselves actually a cat. So what is the difference between the aggregate of cat parts and a cat? To answer that question, notice that a wolf might eat Fluffy's potential parts. And under those conditions, Fluffy's potential parts will be actual wolf parts. What marks those parts as wolf parts as opposed to cat parts? It is the fact that those parts are now in a composition that has the direct ability to engage in activities that are definitive of wolves, and in contrast to activities that are distinctive of cats. Of course, even when those parts compose Fluffy, they had the indirect potential to engage in the wolf-type activities, but not directly. The cat parts needed to be alternatively incorporated into the wolf in order to actualize this potency. Thus, what was an indirect ability to engage in wolf activities while composing a cat becomes a direct ability. The way I put it, the parts of a cat while composing a cat have the being able of a cat, whereas those very same parts have the being able of a wolf while composing a wolf. Thus, what marks Fluffy as a cat and not merely an aggregate of potential cat parts, which are equally potential wolf parts, it's the being able of a cat, the direct disposition toward distinctive feline activities. In the generally Aristotelian tradition, which I have come here today to motivate, the potentially cat parts are called the matter of the cat, and the being able of a cat is called the soul. Fluffy is a compound of matter and soul. We need to be very careful with this compound talk, since being able is not a part or a component in all the way a carbon molecule is. Aristotle famously uses an analogy with the relation of sight to the eye to shed light on the relation of soul to matter. If the eye were a living substance in its own right, then sight would be its soul. That is, what marks the difference between a living eye and merely a set of parts that could be an eye, which could just as easily be parts of a Venus flytrap through sufficient interchanges along the food chain, is the fact that the eye, even when closed, is directly poised to see. It has the ready disposition to produce vision. This power of vision is not a part, but that in virtue of which the potential eye parts actually form an eye, as opposed to something else. Likewise, Fluffy's soul is not a part of Fluffy, but that being poised directly to act in definitively feline ways that is the actuality of his parts forming a cat. Notice, first, that on the Aristotelian story I am telling, the soul has nothing to do with consciousness or mental attributes. The soul is posited as part of an account of the composition of living things in general. The Aristotelian will argue that even non-conscious living things have souls. The cactus is no more identical to its parts than is Fluffy the cat, and it is no less marked by a definitive being able. Thus, the cactus has a soul, even though it is not conscious, at least not in the conventional sense. Of course, if part of the definitive being able of a substance involves consciousness, then having a soul will be a disposition towards such consciousness. Secondly, notice that there is nothing to bar us from a perfectly naturalistic account of the coming to be able of an organism. Fluffy's soul is distinct from his parts, but a natural story about how his parts are properly aggregated is sufficient to account for the coming to be of Fluffy's soul. Finally, Fluffy's soul doesn't interact with Fluffy's matter via external causation. Fluffy's soul is a primary disposition of Fluffy's matter. It is a power of Fluffy as an organism, in virtue of which Fluffy is what he is. He doesn't interact with this being able. He is it, or he does it. Or maybe we should say Fluffy is it because he essentially does it. Fluffy's soul and his matter are not related at all, like balls. It should be clear that there is nothing in the Aristotelian account of soul that runs afoul of methodological naturalism. Moreover, notice that this account, while remaining perfectly naturalistic, does allow that there is nothing truly novel or distinctive about being a cat in contrast. It does allow that there is nothing that there is something truly novel or distinctive about being a cat in contrast to the composing parts of a cat. Fluffy contains no supernatural gizmo in addition to his parts, but he is not just his parts. He is his parts as instantiating a novel being able that is definitive of the feline nature. When the first cat came into being, there was in fact something new under the sun, but that coming to be was a natural coming to be through the organization of physical parts. Fluffy's coming to be and passing away is novel in contrast to his physical constituents, but it is a bodily novelty. I see no reason to exempt human beings from a general account of living things as compounds of matter and soul. Just like Fluffy, the wolf, and the cactus, I am not identical to my parts. I too am subject to the grim prospect of the wood chipper, and I have been engaged in metabolic part exchange with the environment for 45 years, and hopefully decades more. Thus, my parts and I are not identical. What makes my parts actual human parts instead of potential human parts is the presence of the distinctively human being able, a human soul. This soul is not a substance, it is not an individual entity that interacts with my body through external causal relations. Rather, the human soul, like the souls of all other living things, is the unity of material parts, matter, such that it composes a body in virtue of which the direct possession of a definitive ability, of being able. Of course, the human being able is more psychological in nature than that of other living things. Aristotle was not off the mark when he characterized humanity as the rational or linguistic animal. Notice, however, that our being able is not entirely intellectual. For example, the opposed thumb no doubt plays a major role in enabling us to be what we are, and we should not be too quick to draw an unduly sharp line between our intellectual and affective capacities. Nevertheless, the human being able is most centrally our intellectual capacity. It is hard to deny that our intellects are unique among the rational capacities of all other animals. Notice, however, that there is nothing in this account that bars us from giving a naturalistic story about the coming to be of human beings. Though human rationality is distinctive among definitive abilities of all living things, it still has a naturally explicable organization of material parts as a necessary and sufficient condition for its coming to be in its ordinary operation. On the Aristotelian account I am giving, human nature is no counterexample to methodological naturalism. Our coming to be and passing away, though novel with respect to our physical constituents, is a bodily coming to be and passing away, just like Fluffy the cat's. Once again, just as in the case of non-human living things, this is not a reductively naturalistic account. Something novel came into be with the first coming to be of the first human, even though this coming to be was caused by the reorganization of matter. I have no doubt that some of what I have said about human souls will make many of you uncomfortable, and that mainly for theological reasons. Specifically, it may be hard to see how this position can be squared with special creation, the Catholic doctrine to the effect that the human species and each human individual is the product of a direct act by the Creator, and the immortality of the soul. That is all, as they say, a very long story to tell. I will, however, in the time that remains, sketch how these views are compatible with the version of Aristotelianism I have discussed thus far. First, notice this remark by Joseph Ratzinger, as you know, who went on to some position of dogmatic authority in the church. Okay. Quote, "The statement that man is created in a more specific, more direct way by God than he was by other things in nature, when expressed somewhat less metaphorically, means simply this, that man is willed by God in a specific way, not merely as a being that is there, but a being who knows him, who can think about him in return. We call the fact that man is specifically willed by and known by God his special creation," end quote. There then seems to be plenty of theological room to interpret the doctrine of special creation as a claim that the human species and each individual human is intended by the Creator specifically, whatever the process, natural or otherwise, that causes the coming to be of the individual or the species so willed. In other words, special creation need not entail a non-natural coming to be. Minimally, it only commits us to the claim, a claim about what the Creator intends. Such claims are no doubt difficult to justify, but there is no reason to rule it out as something we could have access to de fide or by the faith. The immortality of the soul will come a bit more difficulty. It is very hard to see how sight can survive the destruction of the eye as some sort of independent individual. In fact, I don't believe any version of such an account currently on offer is entirely satisfactory, even ones I've attempted to give. In fact, I'm willing to aver that no such account can be given. Our language is designed to talk about and account for substances, not the non-substantial constituents of substances. So all attempts to shed light in this area are bound to fall into obscurity rather quickly. Indeed, it is on this very issue that the Aristotelian and specifically Thomistic tradition is most consistently and maybe correctly criticized. Nevertheless, I believe some progress on this issue can be made. Bear with me as I introduce yet another analogy. Consider certainly the existence and proper activity of some musical medium is necessary and sufficient for the being of any particular instance of a tune. Suppose a tune is currently being hummed by Cormac, who in his humming satisfies the necessary and sufficient conditions for the being of the tune. That, however, is not to say that some other hummer cannot take up that very same instance of the tune and carry it on, even in the absence of the original hummer. Jack could continue humming even after Cormac has given up the tune. Indeed, the very same instance of the tune might be taken up not by a hummer, but by Brendan playing the trumpet, and yet remain the same tune, or even Patrick could play it on the violin, and we could retain the same tune. Thus, the tune can survive the demise of its original hummer, even though a hummer or some equivalent is necessary and sufficient for its coming to be and acting in the first place. And it can exist in very different ways from how it was originally instantiated, played on a trumpet or a violin as opposed to being hummed. Likewise, the human soul, our being able, has some material organization or other as its necessary and sufficient condition. Nevertheless, it has no particular material organization as a necessary condition. Thus, Nothing bars us from claiming that the human soul can be taken up, like a tomb, in very different material organizations, even those that we cannot recognize as physical in our ordinary sense. The human soul, like all souls, needs to be the being able of something. Souls must be embodied. However, limitations for embodiment, especially if we have the full resources of theism from which to withdraw, from which to draw, are epistemically open to us. There is not much that we can say that is beyond the pale of the possible in these terms. We cannot rule out possibility for souls to be embodied in ways quite foreign to how we find them in our natural earthly dispensation. Thus, I see nothing in the methodologically naturalistic account of soul I have given here that bars us from concluding, for either metaphysical or theological reasons, that the human soul can exist without being the soul of a body at all like the body that currently embodies it. Even beyond what we can call a physical body in the same sense that we use it. All such talk, however, is indeed, as it has been said, to try to see through a glass darkly indeed. Thank you.
So I'm supposed to play the role of the defender of soulless cognitive science. As you'll see, I'm terribly miscast in that role. And there's an enormous amount of what James said that I just straight out agree with.
I was supposed to be the dualist. So.
I also, therefore, I'm going to come at this in a totally different way, different perspective on how to think about the mind-body problem. I'm interested in whether humanity is defensible from the human point of view. And I'm interested in this, as it were, new subject, anthrodesy, which is a kind of exculpatory anthropology. Its name is modeled on Leibniz's famous term, theodicy, which is the attempt to justify the ways of God to reflective humanity. And that's part of ontology, what we philosophers call ontology, and in particular, ontotheology. Now, it's a difficult enterprise, you know, some of you know, many of you know, theodicy, particularly if you mistake humanity as the moral center of God's creation. For there seems to have been immense natural evil on earth before humanity evolved, and so before any potentially creating, disrupting, or deforming fall on our part. That's a kind of hint about how to reconceive of the problem of natural evil. By natural evil, we mean things like the vast system of predation, where one animal slakes its hunger by ripping another apart, an enormous disproportion between the pleasure derived or satisfaction derived from slaking the animal's hunger and the suffering of the animal who is devoured. Nature, we discover more and more, is red and tooth and claw. Darwin himself, one of the most famous observers of nature, said, "What a book a devil's chaplain might write on the clumsy, wasteful, blundering, low, and horribly cruel works of nature." And the hominids are among the cruelest. So what is this anthrodesy? It's the attempt to justify the ways of humanity to reflective humanity. Now, I tried out other names, and I found they were really bad. For example, anthropodicy would be the attempt to justify the ways of anthropods to reflective humanity. Not a very promising enterprise. Anthropods include creepy, crawly things like spiders. Now, my wife, who's the dean of the graduate school, is a paradigm case of reflective humanity, but she hates spiders, so there's no chance for justifying the way of anthropods to humanity. Even worse would be androdesy, justifying the ways of men to reflective humanity, because reflective humanity also includes women, and justifying the ways of men to women is looking increasingly hopeless as time goes by. So what I'm really worried about is that souls, basic sites of rational responsiveness, seem ill-placed, if they're placed at all, among the hominids. And I'm really worried about the question of whether evolution went too far in evolving us. Now, part of this involves our dark past and the appropriate shame we should have about our dark past, but I found that very distressing for people to go through. So I'm just going to start with the way in which cognitive science makes anthrodesy rather difficult. So one thing we need to show if we're to make humanity look good to us is that our apparent mental and moral nature is not a snare and an irredeemable or irremediable delusion. So how does that attempt to justify the ways of humanity to reflective humanity fare given cognitive science? What's cognitive science? I just think of it as the attempt to integrate the local empirical discoveries of neurophysiology, cognitive psychology, developmental psychology, linguistics, computer science, anthropology, and philosophy of mind into a consistent and empirically predictive global picture of humanity's mental and moral nature. Cognitive science is an integrated scientific overview of humanity. Now, cognitive science is understood in a sort of standard way among cognitive scientists. And that way does seem to imply that humanity's apparent mental and moral nature is mere appearance. Cognitive science seems to say that we are deeply deluded about our natures, and not redeemably so. Thanks to the evolution of the human brain, these delusions are persistent and run enormously deep. So how does this bear on the mind-body relation? Here I'll just be reporting for the purposes of discussion. I don't have the time to go into the sophistication or argument that's needed to nail every point, so think of what follows as more of a provocation rather than a proof. Here's the question of anthrodesy. What's the form of a minimally exculpating anthropology? What needs to be true if humanity is not to be counted as an unfortunately deluded evolutionary product? Many things, I think, but here are four that bear directly on the mind-body relation. We have to be, and I'll explain these four things in detail, ontologically and ethically singular. We have to be sources of rational responsiveness to a manifest that is non-virtual reality. Okay, and I'll work backwards in explaining these and explaining why, on a certain view of where cognitive science now stands, things look pretty bad. So a manifest or a virtual reality. If we're not deeply deluded, then the nature of external reality is to some extent disclosed to us. We touch what we see. We don't touch mental images or visual images. More generally, experience presents us with relatively objective features of the manifest world of thought and action. This is important because our emotional responsiveness to each other and to nature is predicated on taking things at experiential face value. If things are not as they appear, then the whole pattern of our emotional responsiveness is mistaken. So imagine a parent holding his child and thinking, I have no idea of the nature of this being. All I know is that it is a something I know not what, which is causing experiences in me now. That doesn't support the kind of emotional attachment that is central to, for example, human nurturing. But on typical cognitive science models of our sensory system, we are already locked inside a biological virtual reality machine in which the whole nature of our experience is determined just by states of our sensory systems. Why is that important? Well, it means the whole course of our life experience could be exactly as it is, even if the world is very different from the way our experience presents it. Any way of getting us into those sensory states, by any means whatsoever, would produce the very same experiences. So in what sense are those experiences revealing or disclosing the actual environment in which we find ourselves? Another issue that's raised by cognitive science is this. If we're not deeply deluded, then in shaping one's own life, one is capable of appreciating reasons that count in favor of courses of action and reasons which count against courses of action, and rationally weighing them and responding accordingly. In this way, one manifests the quality of one's will, one's most distinctive and developing style of responsiveness, in emotional responsiveness, in choice, in judgment, and in bodily action. All that requires that reasons are not just contemporaneous rationalizations or mere material causes, but are effective in virtue of their force as reasons. Where this implies that reasons are effective in virtue of their grasped content. Otherwise, we do not really occupy the space of reasons, we merely gesture at it. There seems to be no hope for a cognitive science model of content causation. At best, there are naturalistic accounts of how we can assign packets of information to certain brain states, but the brain states do all their causing wholly in virtue of their neurochemical features. What about difference-making, freedom? If we're not deeply deluded, then each one of us is a genuine source of choice and action, to some extent able to make a difference to the shape of his or her own life. Otherwise, one's life is just the playing out of a genetic and environmental fate.